Let's go ahead and get started on our 32nd week of our 4.5 year journey through all of God's inspired word, verse by verse. We are in Leviticus chapter 17 as we begin today. And I need to give a heads up to those of you that have younger children in your household. Today will be a PG-13 episode. And so that means you need to take accountability of your kids. If you're not ready to have some very significant conversations with them, you need to get them busy with something else in another room, or you just need to turn this off and then you pick it up online later for yourself. So you should be able to take care of that really quick. And by the time we get to that material today, I should not have any unprepared ears ready to hear. Leviticus is the book of rules given to the Levitical tribe to help them do things appropriately. That included their sacrifices, that included their ceremonies, and it also included how they helped the people in Israel do things the right way. And so Leviticus chapter 17 starts at verse 1 with this. Then he who is spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and to his sons and to all the sons of Israel, and say to them, This is what he who is has commanded, saying, Any man from the house of Israel who slaughters an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp, or who slaughters it outside the camp, and he has not brought it to the doorway of the tent of meeting to present it as an offering to he who is before the tabernacle of he who is, blood guiltiness is to be reckoned to that man. He has shed blood, and that man shall be cut off from among his people. The reason is so that the sons of Israel may bring their sacrifices, which they were sacrificing in the open field, that they may bring them in to he who is at the doorway of the tent of meeting, to the priest, and sacrifice them as sacrifices of peace offerings to he who is. The priest shall sprinkle the blood on the altar of he who is at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and offer up the fat in smoke as a soothing aroma to he who is. They shall no longer sacrifice their sacrifices to the goat demons, or the shaggy things, that's the literal word, with which they play the harlot. This shall be a permanent statute to them throughout their generations. So that's a long section without much of an interruption there. And when you read this in the commentaries, some of the commentaries will apply this to just typical butchering of animals for meat. I don't happen to go along with that understanding of this passage. I believe this passage is all about worship. That up to this point, the Israelis had been engaged in that practice of individual family worship. And so if you wanted to offer a sacrifice to God, then you would build an altar on your property, and you would sacrifice it right there on the altar. And you can see this exemplified in the book of Genesis, where you have Abraham, who builds an altar and calls on the name of the Lord. You have Isaac that does the same thing, and Jacob that does the same thing. When they move to different locations, one of the first things they do is they build an altar, and they sacrifice on it and call upon the name of the Lord. So this was the common procedure all the way up until right now in our text, when the tabernacle becomes the central site for worship, with a priesthood who is charged with making sure that the sacrifices are done appropriately. And so this passage is all about the Israelis needing to switch over to that understanding, that from here on out, when I wish to worship God with a sacrifice, I need to go to the central location, to the tabernacle, and utilize the service of the priests to offer this sacrifice by their hands appropriately. And no more individual sacrifice. And it actually says that right here, that they had been in the habit of offering the sacrifices in the open country, meaning out there somewhere not too far from their homes. But that's going to change now. The thing that becomes more specific about a problem with at least some of the Israelis with their sacrifices up to this moment is that some of them were worshiping other gods and goddesses anyway, and that needs to stop. So verse number 7, let's read this again, because that's specifically about the topic. They shall no longer sacrifice their sacrifices to the goat demons with which they play the harlot. Some of your older versions might have like satyr, and that was the idea of something like Pan. Now, the Greek Pan doesn't come into common understanding among the Israelis until much later. But you probably have enough of a classical understanding of this that it was like a man with a goat's body that went dancing around, particularly out in the wilderness near sources of water with lots of trees and stuff like that. He was like a nature sort of god. Well, that seems to be what's being presented here in verse 7, is that some of the Israelis had been worshiping this spirit demon, this spirit god, this probably a fallen angel that was trying to prank everyone into believing that he had power, so that they would worship him at his different sites in the country. And so the Israelis are now being told, no more of that. You're not going to play around with other gods and goddesses. You are now going to worship God, the Creator God, the real God, He who is the only God, and only He will you worship. So it's got to stop. And that's why we have here, this is a permanent statute to them throughout their generations. Now, strangely enough, there will be times in history after this that we will see prophets setting up sacrificial altars away from the tabernacle and away from the temple. And those are exceptions that God puts in place because at the time of those prophets, they did not have proper access to a cleansed temple, or there was no sincerity in what was going on at the temple. And so those guys are functioning at God's command with an exception to the rule. I'm thinking about people like Elijah, for example, who set up the altar on the top of Mount Carmel, and God ignited the sacrifice there because the people in northern Israel had abandoned all connection with the temple in Jerusalem, and so they kind of needed that sort of guidance. And then there would have been times when the temple no longer existed because of sin of the people. And there would have been individual sacrifices that were being allowed at that time. But the general practice rule, as we're given here, is you only offer sacrifices to God at Jerusalem, or in this case, at the tabernacle, wherever it's set up. Verse number 8, then you shall say to them, any man from the house of Israel, or from the aliens who sojourn with them, who offers a burnt offering or sacrifice and does not bring it to the doorway of the tent of meeting to offer it to He who is, that man shall be cut off from his people. And we've seen this before, and I've suggested to you very strongly that there were kind of three levels of dealing with this issue. In the first case, you basically warned them that they could be shunned if they kept this practiced up. Then if they kept it up, They could be expelled from the area. They could be basically kicked out for continuing this practice. And then the final, the most permanent solution to the problem was they could be executed if they kept doing this thing that they'd been warned about. So God is very, very serious about wanting these sin offerings to only be offered at the tabernacle altar. Now, that's another one of the reasons that I disagree with the commentaries, which say this is about any butchering of any food animal. And I don't see that the people that will eventually be living up in the Galilee, you know, 3 days' walk from Jerusalem, from basically being able to have a kid dinner, a goat dinner, whenever they felt like it, because they didn't want to take an entire week to go down to Jerusalem and offer the blood sacrifice there and then bring the meat back up north and then finally cook it. So I don't think this is about a food butchering. This is about a worship sacrifice. Verse number 10. Any man from the house of Israel or from the aliens who sojourn with him. So these are the people who of their own free will are living in Israel. Most of them are probably thinking about converting to the true faith. So if they're living in Israel, they have to live by the Israeli rules. Even if they haven't totally converted yet, they still have to live by the rules. So any man from the house of Israel or from the aliens who sojourn among them who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from among his people. Now, the eating of the blood that we're talking about here, let's make this perfectly clear, is the arterial blood. It's the blood that comes out of the body of the animal when you slice its throat. It is to be caught as a sacrificial animal, and some of it used in a ceremony, and the rest of that blood is to be poured out on the earth, drained away. So none of that arterial blood is to be eaten. It's to never be going into your mouth. In fact, these guys, when they would butcher the animal, they would cut its throat while it was conscious. And then, of course, they would raise it up to make sure that gravity would help bring the rest of that blood out of the body. They never strangled the animals, because that would mean that the blood would remain inside the body, and that was not appropriate. So this is not talking about the capillary fluid, the blood product that remains in the tissue after the body has been properly bled. So there is no worry here, folks. Those of you that like to eat your steaks a little bit rare, some of you like to eat it a lot rare, but that's not the type of blood we're talking about. We're talking about the arterial blood at the time of the animal's butchering. Now, the reason that this blood is off limits is set forth very clearly in verse number 11, for the life of the flesh is in the blood. So the life is in the blood. And we know that as a scientific fact. The blood is the means by which nutrients for the body and the carbon dioxide exchange that goes on in the lungs, the blood is the transport system for all of that that allows us to continue living. When we quit having a beating heart and the blood quits moving through and doing all of its job, that's death. So the life is in the blood. And I have given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood by reason of the life that makes atonement. So death is the penalty for sin. And so symbolically, blood represents a life given for a life. So remember Ezekiel chapter 18, God puts this principle forward for fairly clearly. The soul that sins is the soul that will die. So the individual that does the sin is the one that will bear the punishment of being separated from God for eternity. Now, symbolically, you need a substitute to die in your place so that you can go on living. So when, under the old covenant system, when you sinned, you would lay your hands upon the animal, which was a perfect animal. It had no blemishes, no indications of some sort of problem with it. So you laid your hands on this innocent animal, typically a young one, that had never done anything wrong. You laid your hands on it and accepted it as your substitute, and then it would die in your place so that you could keep on living. And so you would be symbolically cleansed of your sin. Now, the book of Hebrews, which we will eventually get to after a few more years, also makes it clear that the blood of bulls and goats was never sufficient to remove sin. It was only effective because they represented the ultimate sacrifice, the sacrifice of Jesus, the one who is a human being just like us, who faced every temptation like us, refused to sin, and then offered his life in exchange for ours. And because he's God, he can also offer that life repeatedly in one moment of time on the cross for anyone that wished to accept his substitution. So substitutionary atonement is what we're talking about here. And blood, which gives life, represents the atoning mechanism. And that's why blood needs to be shown a great deal of respect. And that includes something we've already talked about. If you come into contact with blood, such as a woman who is going through her period, or a man who has contact with a woman who's going through her period, you have to show your ultimate respect for that by going through a cleansing ceremony. That's respect for the blood. Verse number 12. Therefore I said to the sons of Israel, no person among you may eat blood, nor may any alien who sojourns among you eat blood. So that is why in Acts chapter number 15, when the leadership of the first church was trying to be forced by the Judaizers into making Gentiles proselytize to Judaism, they said no. They don't have to become Jews, but we will lay down some shared principles that come from well before the law that they must do or must not do, depending on the way you want to phrase it. Number one is that they shouldn't be involved in sexual immorality. And then another one is that they should not be partying with pagans, that is, being involved in the fellowship dinners that are part of the worship of gods and goddesses. And the middle one was that they were not to eat blood or animals that have been strangled and therefore not properly bled out. So even New Testament Christians, such as many of us are, we're not supposed to be eating arterial blood. So that means no blood pudding. That would be a sin for a Christian to eat that. And we don't engage in any of that paganistic practice of when you go out hunting and you make your first kill, you drink some of the blood as you've cut the throat of the animal. That would be a pagan practice and is sinful. Don't do it. Because blood, arterial blood we're talking about here, has two purposes. Number one, it's to give you life. And number two, it was to represent substitutionary atonement. It has no other reasons that we should be using it. So verse 13 goes beyond the sacrificial butchering and talks about game butchering. That is, when you go out into the wild. Verse 13, so when any man from the sons of Israel or from the aliens who sojourn among you in hunting catches a beast or a bird which may be eaten, he shall pour out its blood and cover it with earth. So if you're out hunting deer and you shoot it with a bow and arrow back at this time, or you hit it in the head with a slingshot stone, you immediately rush up to it and cut its throat and let the blood drain out of it into the ground, because you're not supposed to be eating any of that blood. If it's a bird that you've done, you pull off its head if it's a smaller bird, or you cut its throat if it's a larger bird, and you let the blood drain out, because that's the rule. Verse 14, for as for the life of all flesh, its blood is identified with its life. Therefore I said to the sons of Israel, you are not to eat the blood of any flesh, for the life of all flesh is in its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. When any person eats an animal which dies or is torn by beasts, that means it just croaks, right? It just falls over from old age, or maybe, since the other thing here is it gets attacked and it's killed and you come across its corpse. Well, that's going to be a borderline thing. You really should slice its throat immediately and try to bleed it out. And if I were a priest or a Levite living back at this time, my advice to people is, if you slice its throat and nothing comes out, it's too late. Don't eat it. But apparently there was this borderline permission that was given, that if you came across an animal that had recently died or had been recently killed, whether he is a native or an alien, he shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and remain unclean until evening. Then he will become clean. Meaning, you can eat it because you've apparently cut its throat after you found it. But, because this is borderline stuff, you're going to be unclean until you go through this ceremony of washing. Verse 16, but if he does not wash them or bathe his body, then he shall bear his guilt. So you've got to go through proper procedure, even on these borderline things. Chapter number 18 is where we get into some of the very, very blatant sexual commentary. And so this is the reason for the PG-13 thing. Then he who is spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, I am he who is your God. You shall not do what is done in the land of Egypt where you lived, nor are you to do what is done in the land of Canaan where I'm bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You are to perform my judgments and keep my statutes to live in accord with them. I am he who is your God. So you shall keep my statutes and my judgments by which a man may live. If he does them, I am he who is. So this is kind of a bridge reminder here that everything that God says is the rule that should be followed. The Israelis should not be going back to Egyptian rules, and they should not be trying to use the Canaanite rules. They should use God's standard. And then he starts talking about sexual relationships. Now, from the beginning of creation, we know that sexual relationships were intended to be between a husband and a wife, one man, one woman, together for a lifetime. And in the original creation, it was forever. One man, one woman, together forever. But the situation is such that we need clarification as to who is in that pool of possible sexual partners inside that marriage. And we know that some of this is affected by the gene pool. When the gene pool was very deep and fresh and new, then getting married to your half-sister was not that big of a deal. Because it's only when you've got the genetic code starting to deteriorate that getting married to a close relative is a problem. So Abraham was married to his half-sister, Sarai, and that was not a big deal at that time. But here we are, 500 plus years later, in the book of Leviticus, and that is now going to be a relationship that's off the table, because the gene pool has deteriorated since then. So verse number 6, none of you shall approach any blood relative of his to uncover nakedness. I am he who is. Now, uncovering nakedness, that's just a euphemism for sexual contact. Now, it's supposed to be legitimized by marriage. But even outside of marriage, this was not permitted. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father. That is the nakedness of your mother. She's your mother. You are not to uncover her nakedness. So this is a big ooh. No one is supposed to be having sex with their mom. And for that matter, we can flip the genders on this and be perfectly appropriate. No one should be having sex with their dad. Just gross, right? You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife. It is your father's nakedness. Meaning, if your dad remarries, don't be having sex with his wife, your stepmom. That's not appropriate. The nakedness of your sister, either your father's daughter or your mother's daughter, whether born at home or born outside, their nakedness you shall not uncover. So this is the one that would have applied to Abraham. He, under these rules, would not have been able to marry Sarah because she was his half-sister. Well, I see by my clock, we're out of time for the day. So we'll come back to this next time we get into God's Word.